It's now my pleasure then to call Brother Mark forward to deliver the necessary words of exhortation. Brother Mark.
Thanks, Matt, and good morning, everyone. I hope everyone's comfortable. To put things in perspective a bit, Dad reminded me this morning that when Mom and Auntie Grace met in the winter on Sunday mornings and it was cold, they met around a wood-fired stove, so we don't have it that bad. We don't have to cut the wood, at least anyway. In our daily readings over the past few weeks, we've been considering the inspired record of the book of Job, the record of a man we know endured an incredible loss, indescribable loss, a loss that's difficult to understand. Certainly considering Job's character, difficult to understand because it didn't seem fair. And that's the way Job saw it too. It didn't seem fair. He believed he was a righteous man, and he was, even someone who was prepared to accept the good and the bad from God. But, of course, also someone who wanted to know why he had to suffer. He wanted to know why. And of course, that's what's debated throughout most of the book, as we know. A debate that is eventually exhausted. And that is the setting for our reading this morning and in the last couple days. Our reading from the book of Job this morning, and actually beginning a couple days ago, comes at a critical point in the development of the book of Job, a point where Job's friends, who had come to comfort him, had made their argument against him, but couldn't prove him wrong. And at the point where Job had defended his integrity, but couldn't prove that he was right. Point, it seems, where there was no conclusion, no agreed upon reason for what had happened, no lesson to be learned, except for maybe the one sad statement we just read in chapter 34, where it says, and these are Job's words, "It profits a man nothing when he tries to please God." That's a sad statement, isn't it? Thankfully, that wasn't the lesson. There was a lesson for them, and there's a lesson for us as well. And I think as difficult as it may be for us to relate to Job, certainly in the man that he was, and more particularly the loss that he was overcoming, it's difficult for us to relate to him. I don't think any of us, even in our lifetime, would experience the loss that Job experienced all at once. But I think the truth is, in spite of that, that Job is someone that we can all relate to. In part because the book isn't really about pain and suffering, but mostly because in so many ways we are just like Job. Certainly in the way that we perceive ourselves. Job was a good person. He was a good man. And he was confident in that. That does sound like us. A little bit, doesn't it? He was also a slave to his mortality and in need of redemption. And that certainly sounds like us. And in the end, he did learn something. And of course, we all have something to learn, don't we? I'd like to turn first to Job chapter 1, where we're first introduced to Job. And we'll read the first few verses. So Job chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, and I'll be reading from the New International Version this morning. "In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the peoples of the East. Now, I think there's two significant statements made in these verses. One at the end of verse 3, where it says that Job was the greatest man among all the people of the East. And this is probably a statement more about what he had or what he'd become, a statement about how other people viewed him. The more profound statement in these verses is made in verse 1, and it's actually also echoed in verse 8, where God himself says, in verse 8, there is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. That's how God saw him. So in man's eyes and in God's eyes, there was no one like him. But of course, this view of Job was about to be challenged, wasn't it? The claim made against Job in the next few verses, beginning in verse 9, was that it's easy to be upright if you have everything going for you. He had everything that anyone could ever need. His life was easy. The claim was that he was sheltered. It suggested in verse 10 that God had put a hedge up around him to protect him or put him in a position of reduced exposure to risk or sin. Even that God might be propping him up or by blessing him. And so the challenge is presented in verse 11, where it says, stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Take away everything he has, and he won't be blameless. He won't be the man he was before. And as we know, of course, everything was taken away from him. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, countless servants, 7 sons, and 3 daughters. All gone. It's an unimaginable test of character. At the end of verse, or the end of chapter 2, we're told that when Job's 3 friends came to visit him and comfort him, they sat with him and no one said anything for 7 days. They didn't say a word. They were speechless. That's how great his suffering was. What about Job? Did he curse God as the challenge suggested? The answer is in verse 20 of chapter 1. Verse 20 to 22, and these verses for me are amongst the most inspiring in scriptures. This is his response. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. What an incredible attitude. Amazing. Inspiring. The test was applied. Everything that Job had was taken away. And he remained steadfast. There was more to come, wasn't there? The claim then became, you know, this isn't personal enough. So next it says Job was afflicted with sores from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. And even his wife turned against him. In verse 9 of chapter 2, she says, are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. Can you imagine that kind of support? All that was left for him, she suggested, was death. But he responds to that, doesn't he? And keeps his integrity. Verse 10 of chapter 2, partway through, he says, shall we accept good from God and not trouble. In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Throughout all this, in spite of everything that had been taken away, Job maintained his integrity, his character. And I don't think it was because it was the only thing that he had left. I think it was because the only thing was the only thing that couldn't be taken away. Job remained upright. When we're introduced to him, he was blameless. When the test was applied, he remained blameless. Still blameless. So God's view of him was correct. Not that there was anything that God needed to learn. He knew the end from the beginning. He didn't have any reason either directly to cause Job to suffer. But he did have a purpose, and for that purpose to have any meaning, Job's character had to be established. And it was. But also, what had to be established was the human understanding of God and his character and his purpose. And we'll see that, of course, as the book unfolds. In chapter 3, Job's three friends, we know, visit him and sit with him for 7 days, and there's nothing to say. They were speechless. Eventually, it's Job that breaks the silence, and he's looking for answers. You know, even his three friends were looking for answers. They were trying to reconcile what happened. They were genuinely affected by his suffering and were trying to genuinely understand why he was in this position. But Job asked why, and they only had one answer, didn't they? Their suggestion was that sinners suffer. So therefore, if Job was suffering, he must be a sinner. That was the only conclusion that they could come up with. But that wasn't why Job was suffering, was it? And Job was prepared to defend himself. He was prepared to defend this position. He knew that they were wrong. And he defends his innocence. And the more he does, the more they accuse him. But Job remained confident. Turn to chapter 27. Job 27. Here, Job states his position, makes it very clear. Job 27, verse 6. This is Job speaking. He says, I will maintain my righteousness and never let go of it. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. So it's pretty clear what his position was, wasn't it? And he continues his defense up until the end of chapter 31, where he says, among other things, you know, I haven't looked lustfully at a woman. I've been fair to my servants. I haven't denied the poor, the widow, or the fatherless. I haven't put my trust in gold or wealth. I haven't rejoiced in my enemy's misfortunes. All this proof, all these examples of what a good man he was. All true. He felt compelled to defend himself, to defend his character, to defend his righteousness. And eventually he says in verse 35 of chapter 31, I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. And God was going to answer him, wasn't he? And so at the beginning of chapter 32, the focus of the book shifts from Job's defense and the judgment of his three friends from man's understanding to God's understanding. The end of chapter 31, at the end of verse 40, actually, it says the words of Job were ended. And in verse 1 of chapter 32, it says, so these three men, his three friends, stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Job had finished his defense. his three friends had stopped answering him, because it says he was righteous in his own eyes. And I think we can maybe read over that a little bit quickly, and we might miss something if we do in that statement, because I think it actually gives us a hint to the problem. Turn back to Job chapter 29. Look at verse 14. This is Job speaking. Job 29, verse 14. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I think in this statement, he may have unwittingly identified the problem. Job was blameless, and he was confident in this, and likely thought that that was enough. The problem was he was defending himself with his own righteousness. He thought his relationship with God depended on his righteousness. That was his covering. Of course, the true lesson of this book is not about suffering, not about why we suffer. It's about righteousness and our limited view of it. That's why there was no resolution to this debate. So as chapter 32 begins, we're introduced to Elihu, who had been listening to the arguments, who had been listening to both sides that were presented, and he wasn't very happy. In verse 2, it says he was angry with Job because he justified himself rather than God, and in verse 3, we're told that he's also angry with Job's three friends, because they condemned him even though they couldn't find any fault in him. And then Elihu begins to point them in the right direction, beginning in verse 6 of chapter 32, where he says, I'm young in years and you are old. That is why I was fearful, not daring to tell you what I know. I thought age should speak, advanced years should teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in a man, the breath of the Almighty, that gives him understanding. It's not only the old who are wise, not only the aged who understand what is right. Therefore, I say to you, listen to me. I too would tell you what I know. I waited while you spoke. I listened to your reason while you were searching for words. I gave you my full account or full attention. But not one of you has proved Job wrong. None of you has answered his arguments. Elihu let Job and his three friends speak. He listened to their argument. He let them speak first because they were older than him, that he respected them, respected any wisdom that they had to offer. But when they had no answer, Elihu reminds them, and we see this in the following chapters, that true wisdom comes from God. It can't be found in man's limited understanding. Job's conclusion was that there was nothing to gain from not sinning. But Job was wrong about that, and also wrong about justifying himself. And so Elihu begins to point him in the right direction. Verse 33, chapter 34. Here Elihu says, should God then reward you on your terms when you refuse to repent? That was the perspective that Job was missing. And so Elihu's exhortation in verse 32 is, teach me what I cannot see. And what couldn't be seen was that ultimately man shouldn't be dependent on himself and on his own understanding, on his terms, but in God. And this becomes evident when God answers Job, beginning in chapter 38. 38, verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me, if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Verse 8, who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? Verse 12, have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? Verse 18, have you comprehended the vast expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Chapter 39, verse 18, do you give the horse his strength or clothe his neck with a flowing mane? Verse 26, does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread his wings towards the south? Incredibly powerful statements. Statements that truly reveal a contrast between human wisdom and divine wisdom. And so God eventually asks in verse 1 of chapter 40, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. That was the question for Job. And it was humbling. In verse 4, Job says, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? This was a challenge for Job, a challenge that is repeated in verse 14. If Job could create and control, even understand all these things, then God says in verse 14, then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. But Job couldn't respond, could he? He couldn't sit in God's position. And he had to understand that in the end. Nothing he could do to save himself. That salvation, of course, is only possible with God. And that's the lesson here, that in spite of our efforts, in spite of our righteousness, we can't save ourselves. Something more, something greater is required. Turn to James chapter 5. James chapter 5, verses 10 and 11. These are the only verses, the only account where Job is mentioned in the New Testament. James 5, verses 10 and 11. Brothers, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. So there is something to be learned in suffering, in perseverance. Even the righteous suffer. Good things and bad things happen to the righteous. Job understood that. God allows suffering. It's within his purpose. And we are being shaped and molded after all, aren't we? And whatever happens will always work out for the greater good. But there is a greater lesson. In the end, we see what God finally brought about in the life of Job. We see that God is actually full of compassion and mercy, and that God is more understanding of us than we are of him. So what do we learn about ourselves? That we're not self-sufficient. We rely on God, who is all-sufficient. We need to pursue an understanding of righteousness that is outside of our understanding. We can't get caught up in our own perception, our own understanding, our own terms. That's what happened to Job and his friends. It's not about our righteousness. It's about something beyond that, beyond our regular thinking. Because our perception is often wrong, isn't it? The true measure of righteousness is not revealed in us. It's revealed in him. It's not about what we've done or what we've accomplished. It's about what's been done for us. That's why we're here this morning. Not because we're righteous, but because of what his righteousness reveals and what his love and understanding has provided.